out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 9th of May 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com, and we are actually broadcasting live today because we have with us Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, how are you doing today?
Do you know what male ballerinas are called?
Ballet dancers? No, I don't.
Ballerina is feminine, so I wonder what male ballerinas are called, if there's a specific word for it. And it's been bugging me for the last 10 minutes.
I thought it was ballet dancer.
Just that? Okay. Well, that seems to be, okay.
Ballet dancer, right, and ballerina? That seems to make sense to me. And just so while, go on.
There's a word for female dancers, but not for male dancers. That doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't. But because, you know, the female dancers do need the male dancers there as well. Don't normally just have female dancers, do you? You've got to have the male dancers with the strength to pick the female dancers up. But just while we're on the subject of music, I just wanted to mention, I expect most of our listeners are already aware, Eternal Reich has got a new album out, and you can purchase that at Bandcamp. We've got an advert for it in the sidebar of the site. I think it's got 18 new tunes on there, or 18 remixed tunes on there. It's great value for money, only $7, which is £5. So go and check that out. And also, as well as having a new album out by one of our hosts, we also have a new book out by one of our hosts, the co-host that I have with me today. Matt, you have a new book out at the Barnes Review for sale, $25. Tell us about this book. It looks really interesting. The Soviet Experiment, Challenging the Apologists for Communist Tyranny.
Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that back in the 70s, there was a full Holocaust denial movement in American academia claiming that Stalin, you know, wasn't all that bad. And really that the Soviet Union wasn't all that bad, using very similar arguments to, you know, what Holocaust denials concerning the Third Reich would use. And this was acceptable, and this was subsidized, and this, you know, they had seminars and everything else, and no one said a word about it. I think when the archives were opened in 1991, that all changed, and they were shut up because there was no question about how bad the USSR was when all these documents came out, despite the party's attempts to hide them. And over the last, you know, 25 years, this flood of information on what the Soviet Union really was is overwhelming. And it shows that people like, you know, Senator McCarthy were right, that everything that the right was saying since the 30s was absolutely correct about the Soviet Union. But I noticed that all of my essays seemed to have a theme. They all came around to a few very similar arguments, one of which is that American academics take the Soviet government at their word, that when they use a word like worker or proletarian, that they're using the word in the same sense that we would use it. And of course, that's not true. You know, the U.S., when we talk about the sanctions on Russia today, none of that existed. I was just brushing up on my Anthony Sutton. I have a whole section in my book on using him among many other sources, showing how every sector of Soviet heavy industry was built by Western companies under license in the USSR. In fact, it was so bad that Stalin began to worry about Soviet independence, economically speaking. Everything people know about this era, everything people know, you know, is fantasy. And only when Russia became this Eurasianist power suddenly now they're evil. But during the Cold War, American trade and aid and assistance to the USSR in every sector continued and was very profitable. And I don't know, it's the biggest open secret of the 20th century, I would say.
So the anti-communism that we were hearing about, the talking about being anti the communist state and anti the USSR, that was a bit of a scam. And I see that is actually one of the titles of some of the chapters in it. I think there's about 10 or 12 separate essays that actually make up this book. And I've got some of the titles from them here, and I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about them. And the first one is Marx and Lenin on the European revolutions of the 19th century. So is this what Marx and Lenin wrote about the European revolutions of the 19th century? What's this first one about?
Yeah, it's something I did a long time ago. It really has to do with 1848, 1872, and of course the Paris Commune. But more than that, the main focus of it is their apologetics for terrorism, which is what this was all about. That they realized that what they call the bourgeois system needed to be all kinds of irregular, non-judicial kind of terror has to be used. And this is where they developed their idea that these people weren't nasty enough. They weren't horrible enough. The other thing that comes from this chapter is when Marx, now not Lenin, not Stalin, but Marx himself says that there was no way that workers could control any worker movement. None of the members of the top members of the Soviet Party were from the working class. Karl Marx was not from the working class. Certainly Engels was a bourgeois business owner. So some of their basic assumptions came from their analysis of the 19th century. And the two big things, of course, are the use of terror, and that this is perfectly okay, and that this isn't really about workers. The party is separate from labor. Workers are simply too dumb and really too conservative, frankly, to have any real role in running a revolution. And this is why the anarchist Bakunin was kicked out of the First International by Marx personally. And in reply, Bakunin said that Marx is being financed by the Rothschilds, that this is a Jewish movement. And I have the feeling that anarchists the world over, you know, spend a lot of time pretending he never said that. But Bakunin is the grandfather of anarchism in general. And he penned a vicious attack on Marx, saying that this is he is what he is because of the Jewish banking clan in London. So there was no question. So that's what this is about. This is, you know, how the ideology developed that would later then take over the USSR.
Did they mention the French Revolution? I mean, you're saying there that they thought that the European revolutions of the 19th century, they weren't harsh enough, they weren't hard enough on the people, they weren't terrorists enough. Did Marx have a view on the French Revolution? Do you know what did he think of that?
Yeah, they're unified in this respect. excuse me. As far as their philosophy of history is concerned, the feudal system was destroyed by the French Revolution, you know, the monarchy, the church, et cetera. And the bourgeois system was created, you know, focused around private property. Once that reaches a point of oligarchy, then you have revolutions afterwards. So it was a first necessary step in history working itself out. The feudal system was destroyed by revolution like that. There isn't the industrial base for any kind of real socialist movement, although there were socialists that were part of the French Revolution. But once the property rights began to conflict with basic morality, the Marxist Revolution would then come after that. So you have to have the revolution to get rid of feudalism, and then the revolution to get rid of capitalism, and that has to be done, you know, in sequence.
So we can see a line really going from the French Revolution then through all the others to the Bolshevik Revolution, each one picking up pace, each one worse than the last. And then you say that one of the other titles here is the Allied Intervention in the Russian Civil War, the Myth of Western Anti-Communism. So what was this bit about? When was the Russian Civil War, first of all?
Well, it was from the end of World War I. you know, which really for Russia is 1917, to roughly 1921. Now, there's plenty of Russian, you know, the white emigres who would say the Civil War continued straight up until the German invasion because the people resisted collectivization with such violence. But this is a very, very important thesis for me. I'm almost triggered these days when people talk about how the U.S. and the British, you know, the Entente, how they intervened in the Russian Civil War to support the white armies. The exact opposite is true. The West was highly sympathetic to the Reds. Now, they didn't know what Bolshevism was. Very few of them knew what Marxism was. And they really didn't care. All they saw was a strong state being formed that could serve the check on Germany. That was their big issue. And they certainly were very willing to have Western investment come in and build their paradise. I mean, even today, I think, you know, it's not a well-known thing. It's the ideology, the philosophical parts of it are not interesting. They didn't know what a Bolshevist was. But the whites were out of the question. And whenever, like, someone like Woodrow Wilson, whenever he would get anti-red, without exception, it would be because they were acting like a czar, or they were acting like an old Russia. Otherwise, he couldn't get enough of them. And although they weren't recognized right away, you know, trade and aid and assistance, you know, God, the Japanese were told to stand down. They could have destroyed the party in the East. The British were told to stand down. They could have destroyed the Petrograd Soviet. Kolchak and Denikin both say that they never got a penny or a bullet from the West. By the end of the Civil War, the white armies were using weapons that they captured from the Reds, ammunition captured from the Reds. And one of the reasons that they lost is that they really didn't have the equipment. They had far more money. They had far more – I mean they had the old Tsarist treasury, which they captured in Katrinburg. But no one would sell them anything. They had far more money and far more competent leadership than the Reds. But we don't have any equipment. You can't fight a war. And this is, in fact, there were, you know, as far as the other myth is that these were, you know, the old nobility were running the white forces. Frankly, the Reds had more noble generals than the whites did. Only about 15% of the white forces came from any of the old noble class. Everything. I mean, it's all mythology. But it's a huge pet peeve of mine for anyone to act like during the Civil War, the West intervened on the whites' behalf. No, the West intervened on the Reds' behalf over and over and over again.
Well, I can recall it. It's a bit strange that the Tsar asked for help and Britain refused to help him, even though the British king was very, very similar to him. They were related, and Britain just didn't help. And Winston Churchill, he wrote about the communists. He did sort of highlight the fact that they were carrying out these crimes, but then they just didn't do anything about it. I mean, did you factor that into this bit here that you were talking about, Matt, Winston Churchill's expose of it?
Yeah. Well, that was a bit later. But, you know, he also made it clear that, you know, all sides in the war committed these crimes. The great contribution of Churchill was to say that this is an ethnic movement. I don't think anyone believed that they believed in some kind of equality or that they believed in a utopian system. I don't think anyone believed that. What they got was someone who believed in a very strong state. So Churchill's stuff, you know, you had the rest of the American Western press talking about white atrocities constantly. And I know I've written in the New York Times from the era that says, you know, these are social reformers. Trotsky worked for a newspaper in Brooklyn. You know, these are our people, that kind of thing. And so, there certainly were Russians and those close to Russia, especially those in Germany, who knew the story. But no one in the U.S. was listening.
And nobody did anything about it. Well, the next title I picked out here is Self-Indulgent Historical Mythology, The Fantasy of Stalin's Anti-Semitic Russian Nationalism. And this is something we still hear a lot about, how Stalin was anti-Semitic, and he had all these anti-Jewish purges. Although, as far as I know, or I'm aware, anti-Semitism was a capital offence in the USSR. So what was going on here then? The fantasy of Stalin's anti-Semitic Russian nationalism. What was the truth about that?
Well, as I've said many times, Stalin's writings aren't secret. Everything has been translated into English. Unfortunately, there are many volumes. He was not just a thug like some people think. I mean, he had a very coherent ideology. But in no way was he a Russian nationalist. Like you said, anti-Semitism was, and he says this to an American journalist early on in his tenure. He says, I'm going to enforce this. This is what we're all about. Stalin had an entire scheme for an international language made up of a mix of all the major languages of the world. He married two Jews, and those children married Jews. He had tickets to the Yiddish theater, so he at least understood the language. And it comes down to Solzhenitsyn's 200 years together, and he has the same position I do, where he lists the army of Jews promoted by Stalin in the Stalinist system in every respect, militarily, bureaucratically, artistically, and everything else. The very, very opposite of what an anti-Semite would do. He was an internationalist. He was a philo-Semite. But you think from the point of view of the American academic or the American journalist, Stalin begins purging some of his opponents. And these aren't ideological opponents. These are personal opponents from the old Bolsheviks, the old party, the original, revolutionary movement from the very early 20th century. Well, they're all Jews. At the high levels, they were all Jews. So if you're an American academic, what do? You can't say that, the Bolshevik movement was Jewish. They're not allowed to say that. So they had to invent the myth that he was an anti-Semite and deliberately picked out Jews among them and persecuted them and was just as bad as Hitler was once it became fashionable to turn on Stalin. The left has this tendency, when it wants everyone to hate a certain leader or a certain movement, they have to appeal to both sides. So for Stalin, the right always, of course, hated him because of Bolshevism, but they also began appealing to the left, saying, oh, you see, he was just a nationalist and anti-Semite, so you don't have to like him either, even though every Jewish communist movement around the world when Stalin was alive was a big supporter of his. The split between Stalin and Trotsky had nothing to do with ideology. It had nothing to do with tactics, had nothing to do with their mentality. But Trotsky was a Jewish nationalist, and he was somebody who really spread the mythology that he was doing this not because Bolshevism is Jewish, but because Stalin is an irrational anti-Semite. So you see it from their point of view. They can't come out and say, oh yeah, he purged the old Bolsheviks, every last one of them is Jewish. They can't say that. So they invented this story, he's just as bad as Hitler kind of thing.
I've read Colin Jordan's book on the subject as well, and he says it was basically one faction of Jews against another faction. Yes, Stalin did get rid of a lot of Jews, and then he replaced them all with another lot of Jews. Which, just proves your theory there, and you're adding to it there by saying that in the way that it was reported, they couldn't very well say, well, all these people he's purged are Jews because all the Bolsheviks were Jews at the top. So we can see that this story is getting added to all the time. We're finding out more about what really went on. So what went on with the Christians there? We've talked about this Jewish purges, because another one of the titles is Soviet Ideology, Western Delusion and the Russian Orthodox Church in the USSR. So what's that one about?
At the end of World War II, Stalin decided that he was going to restore the patriarchate of the Russian church and kind of keep this very small pet church for his own purposes. The Western Western press immediately said that there was no more persecution of Christians in the Soviet Union, that he was a Christian man. And the real purpose of him creating this church, which is the Moscow Patriarchate today, unfortunately, is to send them to the World Council of Churches and other organizations like that to support Soviet ends. I've read pretty much every article in the Journal of the Russian Patriarchate from the 40s and 50s. And when Stalin died in 53, the Orthodox Church, well, I mean, you know, the, not the Orthodox Church, but these bureaucrats, patriarch at the time, called him the savior of Christianity, called him almost equal to Christ, the saint. That all he cared about was the health and welfare of the Orthodox Church. This is the kind of sycophantic nonsense that these guys were saying. And in essence, they were told they'd be spared and some of their friends would be spared if you tell the world that there's no persecution here. And so they would bring – the Anglicans were especially stupid. They'd be brought over. They'd be shown Potemkin villages, and he'd go back to Kent and say how wonderful how the religious liberty that exists in the USSR. So the entire point of that church, which wasn't very big, of course, was to fool the West. The Orthodox Church existed underground. I'm a part of one of those underground groups that since the 90s has come above ground. My bishop was one of these guys. Or they were in exile all throughout Europe, and they became the Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia, or sometimes in exile. They left both the Europe and through China as well, from the other side of Russia. That's where the Orthodox Church was. I'm not saying there aren't good people in the Patriarchate, but no one took them seriously at the time. The point was to create some kind of a Russian movement against a German invader, even late in the game. And to create some fake civic nationalism for the sake of driving the Germans out, and because he didn't shut down and burn as many churches as his predecessors did, he becomes a Christian in the eyes of Western annals. So it's again, Stalin was no different in that respect than Trotsky or Lenin.
Was Moscow the center of the Eastern Orthodox Church? I know you've got your book, The Third Rome, referring to Moscow as the Third Rome. Was it the center of the Eastern Orthodox Church?
Well, only in the sense that it's the largest. You know, 4/5 of the Orthodox Church is, Russian, Ukrainian, or Belarusian. But that isn't particularly important. There is no papal chair in Orthodoxy. Things function through authority rather than power. It's a monastic-based church. It's based on asceticism and a shared doctrine. There is absolutely no sense that one bishop is superior to another. And it's always been, of course, the big battle with the Church of Rome. And of course, once the state, which was the protector of the church, collapsed in 1917, the church had to completely reorient itself to this new world, and it did a very poor job of it. Now, when I say the church, I'm referring to bishops and abbots and stuff like that. I don't mean the church as such, but as far as the human side of things are concerned, we understand why the state has such a strong role in church life, because without it, they could be pretty awful to one another.
And what was the Orthodox Church in Russia, the Moscow Patriarchate? What was their position on the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia? Were they trying to hunt them down, you had these two different churches organized, existing at the same time, one in Russia and one outside of Russia?
Yeah, they were anathematized. Metropolitan Anastasi was the head of that church, sided with Hitler in World War II. Quite vociferously, actually, and that was sufficient, for them to say these are traitors, these are fascist enemies, everything else. Hitler created his own diocese of the church under Metropolitan Seraphim Leib, was the essentially the archdiocese of the Reich. However large the Reich would become, that would be Metropolitan Seraphim's jurisdiction, and. Of course, he was in full communion with the rest of the church, except in the Soviet Union, for his whole life, was considered a great man. Hitler rebuilt the Berlin Cathedral with his own money, his own personal money, not state money. And in the letter that Anastasi wrote Hitler in the late 30s, thanking him for it, he used the rebuilding of the cathedral as a metaphor for his rebuilding of Germany. And he says, one day we'll have a Hitler in Russia that will do the great things that you've done here. In the meantime, you know, and then, of course, when he invaded the Soviet Union, he got a flurry of blessings and support from the church. So as far as the Moscow Patriarchate was concerned, so it was so bad that the Church in Exile had a college of secret bishops that were consecrated because it was assumed that eventually they'll all be killed. The major ones would be killed. People, and so there's an underground group of bishops that almost a shadow set of bishops that could take over once these guys were murdered. So that's how bad it was. And of course, needless to say, they were very suspicious of outsiders. You know, some of these guys are still around, and it was very difficult. So they actually had to consecrate bishops secretly, just in case the bishop that everyone knew would be murdered, and they were expecting them to be murdered.
You say there about Hitler building the cathedral in Berlin with his own money. I can almost see a parallel with that. After the USSR fell, they rebuilt the cathedral, that huge cathedral. I forget the name of it, in the middle of Moscow, a brand new one that Pussy Riot went in and desecrated. I think Putin.
Oh, the Savior,
Savior Cathedral. It just seems to me that there's a bit of a parallel there. And then finally, you then. In one of the later essays, you infer that the real communism, the real workers' paradise, was in actual fact being built in the West. In an essay entitled Russian History and the Myth of the Cold War, Western Capitalism as the Builder of the Workers' Paradise. Is that what you're saying there? So the real communism was being built in the West?
No. What I mean is that Soviet heavy industry was a product of Western companies. And it's not just because, you know, by the early 20s, the Soviets didn't have the competent engineers and scientists you would need to create a modern economy. They were either dead in exile or too frightened to do anything. So they became quite dependent on Western assistance. I mean, General Electric laid their electric grid. Henry Ford built the largest truck plant in the world in eastern Ukraine. In 1936, both British and American mining companies had taken over gold and manganese mines in the country. Standard Oil, of course, Rockefellers had taken over the oil fields in the Caucasus. The entire economy of the USSR, industrial economy of the USSR, was built by Western investors, and it was a monopoly license that would be granted by the USSR. And Sutton goes into great detail about this in his multi-volume work on the subject. And Solzhenitsyn mentions it quite a bit too. And then once they got the know-how, that was it. They kicked him out. You know, they just didn't need him anymore. And of course, at the same time, remember, Russian scientists or Soviet scientists are being trained in American and British universities. And they graduate, they come back, and they build this. And this is well known. And so pretty much everything that the Soviets built came from Western ability, Western know-how, Western investment. Especially at a time of the Great Depression in the West, you know, it was almost like there was an ideological reason for this. I mean, profits were made, but they just, you know, American capitalism did not see a threat with the Soviet Union. In fact, they saw it as the ultimate opportunity to make profits. These were not enemy countries. You can't have two countries that are considered enemies. They do nothing but trade with one another and assist one another. So that's why the Cold War is a myth. So now what I mean there is that Soviet heavy industry was built in Russia by Western corporations.
And then when it all fell down, the oligarchs were able to hoover it all up. Is that essentially what happened?
Yeah, that is what happened. Starting in the 1970s, the capital built after World War II was getting old. And depreciation has a tendency to be exponential over time. And there were so many problems with the system. There was no transition from heavy industry to consumer goods, like the US was promoting at the time. They never could make that transition. They didn't want to make that transition. They knew that they were falling behind. And the profits from these corporations were getting smaller and smaller. So by the late 80s, these were pretty much antiques. So when the system collapsed, these exclusively Jewish oligarchs just kind of sucked up what was left and sold off and parceled out these old companies and took what was left, and then ruled the country until Putin came around. And that's exactly what happened. So on the one hand, the Jewish party in the 20s and 30s took over all productive capital and work in the Soviet Union for themselves. And then when it all collapsed in the late 80s, early 90s, they did it again. Although in this time it was just, you know, partitioning off what was left off and getting what they could and getting out of there. You notice the Jews turned on the Soviet Union in the 1970s. They began leaving the country. They began going to Israel because the prophets simply weren't there anymore. And because of that, you had some anti-Jewish opinion amongst Soviet Communist Party leaders. And all of a sudden, it became fashionable to be anti-communist. I'm not saying the trade didn't stop. Of course it didn't. But the Jackson-Vanik Amendment was this law passed the Congress that there's going to be certain, for the first time, sanctions on Russia or the Soviet Union if they prevent Jews from emigrating to Israel. So finally, they go get around in the so-called Cold War to punish the Soviet Union, but only when it, as it concerns the Jews. And this is why the oligarchs were so Jewish, because these guys were, you know, had turned on the Soviet system. That they simply were just, you know, picking the carcass at that point.
Because for quite some time, it was one group of Jews was joining Zionism, and another group of Jews was joining communism. And then eventually, you've got them leaving the communism to move to Israel, fleeing the sinking ship, and then 2 decades later, it all falls down. So that was almost like a warning of it, that these Jews were leaving and making such a noise about being allowed to leave for Israel. Anyway, Matt, this has been fantastic. Really, really interesting stuff. Thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, you can buy the book for $25 at the Barnes Review. It's called The Soviet Experiment, Challenging the Apologists for Communist Tyranny. And I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Lampshade. God bless and hail victory.
Radio Aryan. Dot.